This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for All Good Poems Wear Travelling Shoes with me, Ian Loughran. It's poetry on the radio, readings, interviews with local and visiting poets, and news about events and book launches. From the beautiful to the intriguing and provocative, there's something for everyone. All Good Poems Wear Travelling Shoes, brought to you by the University Bookshop.
Very, very pleased to have my guest today, Peter Olds. And I'm going to read a short bio of Peter. As with many of the poets who have been lucky enough to get on this show, you could go on for a very long time about all their literary achievements, but we'll pot this one to Peter Olds was Robert Burns Fellow in 1978. In 2005, he was the inaugural recipient of the Janet Frame Trust Award for Poetry. He has been included in the Best New Zealand Poems 2011 with his Disjointed on Wellington Station. His works include Lady Moss Revived in 1972, Freeway of 1974, Doctor's Rock 1976, Beethoven's Guitar 1980, After Looking for Broadway 1985, Music Therapy 2001, Poetry Reading at Kaka Point 2006, In the Dragon Cafe 2007, Under the Dundas Street Bridge 2012, and Selection of Poems You Fit the Description 2014. Welcome, Peter. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We're going to start with a poem, and why not?
Yeah. From Under the Dundas Street Bridge, and it is the title poem, Under the Dundas Street Bridge. People, when they ask us, where do you live? We tell them, under the Dundas Street Bridge. They laugh. They cannot see what we can see. Bottles, eels, mattresses, paradise ducks floating downstream. They can't see how cozy we can be with just a fire, our faggots of sticks, our sandwiches, our coffee cups and books. They don't know we have candles and blankets and problems with the doormat like everyone else. They can't see the other side with its weeds and stormwater pipes thick with stormwater. People, when they ask us, what do you eat? We tell them, eels, bottles, puha, and mattresses. They don't see the flow of visitors, the koha of bread, baked beans and eggs. They weren't there the night the river flooded and took away our nasturtium plants. They wouldn't know the time it took us to put the house back in order, the bickering over the last cigarette, the hospital visits, the power failure, the shock when the doctors closed our case. And we, stranded on opposite sides of the river, not talking, the river stripping everything we had between us, leaving us hugging our knees like two canvas bags tied with string. People, when they ask us, why are you happy? We tell them, bottles, eels, mattresses, Vicks, vapor rub, long hair and comics. When the phone rings, we let it ring. When the gas man calls, we let him in. We share our cigarettes with strangers. We eat porridge every day. The gas man is our friend. He gives us gas on credit. We wouldn't be without it. People, when they ask us, why do you live under the Dundas Street Bridge? We tell them.
Thank you, Peter. In the introduction to that collection, Under the Dundas Street Bridge, there's a couple of quotes. Joyce Carey, everyone but a lunatic has a reason for what he does. And Jack Kerouac's, I don't know, I don't care, and it doesn't make any difference. Is that a comment on reason for poetry or reason for life or something else?
Both those quotes seem to fit my state of mind, you know, most of the time, I think. I don't know where poetry fits in. It's like doors in a house or a piece of iron on a fence or something. It has a function, but sometimes, you know, the door gets blown open and the fence rattles. But no, I don't know. If I do use quotes, and I don't do it very often, it's because when I found them, they just had some profound meaning for me of some sort, you know, so just resonated with something inside, but no other reason that I just like what the sentiment held in it.
Yeah, right. And is there a reason behind poetry for you yourself, why you got into it in the first place, why you do it?
Well, the various reasons, I suppose, why I did get into it, I was pretty young. It was the mid-60s. I was putting Auckland behind me at the time, and I found Dunedin, and I wandered around for 6 months, not quite homeless, living in boarding houses, but pretty lonely, just relying on coffee bars and jukeboxes for company, you know. I had a job. I was working in a kitchen as a kitchen hand, I'd become interested in folk music in the early 60s, you know, Donovan, Peter, Paul and Mary, Dylan, of course, and The Master, I had played a ukulele a bit when I was a young kid, and I used to go to these folk clubs in Auckland and in Wellington later on and sit up half the night in these coffee bars listening to folk singers, and I thought, if they can do that, so can I, you know. I want to be a folk singer. It just touched something, you know. Yeah. And I always felt, I already felt like an outsider, and this was something, this was my first sort of touch with Bohemia, I suppose. And then, of course, the Beatles came in with that, and the early Rolling Stones, their rendition of the blues was the first time I heard the blues. And I wanted to learn to play the guitar, and I thought, if I master the guitar, maybe I can write some songs and get famous and retire at 21, you know. And I needed something to do, you know. I needed something to justify my existence, as people seem to require each individual to, you know, have a reason for living, you know, and be putting something back to the into the community. And I was brought up in a parsonage, a Methodist parsonage, and it was pretty strict, and it was very straight up and down and straightforward. And you worked, you ate your porridge, you slept, you got up early, and you went to work again. And sometime down the line, you expected to get married and raise kids and that. Well, that went totally against what I was feeling. So I was rescued really by folk music, rock and roll, Bob Dylan, the Beatles, and all that. It's a big cliche now. A lot of people coming forward in their biographies and now saying what a great influence the Beatles and Bob Dylan and the early 60s music, late 50s, early 60s music on youth culture and so on, you know. So I guess like a drug, I got in there and I couldn't get back out, you know. And it became something. I had many trials when I was young. When I say young, between my late teens and into my early and mid-20s, you know, I was in and out of hospitals. I had all sorts of problems. The music did save me too, but poetry, writing, I won't say poetry, I'll say writing saved me, because I didn't think what I wrote was poetry, and it wasn't, they weren't songs either, though. I wanted to write songs. They were more like short stories.
Okay.
And it was about a time when I started reading Jack London's short stories, which just blew me away, you know. And I'd been introduced to the Globe Theatre. Hilary Baxter James K. Baxter's daughter.
Yeah.
I became friendly with her and around the jukebox and the Hobnob coffee bar and downstairs, you know, in the exchange. Anyway, she took me up to meet Patrick Carey, and I'd been a window dresser in another life on Queen Street, Auckland. And I thought, well, I could probably fit in here and help build sets. And Patrick Carey was pretty keen on that. I don't know if he was impressed about me being a window dresser, but I thought I could, I might be able to do some work at the Globe Theatre, you know, putting sets together. So.
Yeah, and you met James K. Baxter through Hillary?
It was through Hillary, yeah.
Do you recall the meeting?
Well, it was in this coffee bar called the Hobnob, which was mainly of interest to younger people, you know, teens and early 20s sort of group, and had a jukebox in it, well stocked with all the latest singles. I met Hillary in the coffee bar, and during the course of a particular conversation, she told me that her father was a poet, and I said, oh, yes, my idea of poets, I had absolutely no knowledge, really, of literature or poetry or anything. But I had this picture in my head of poets were real people, but they lived in England, and they lived in large country houses, and they wore tweeds and corduroys. And I thought, he can't be a real poet because he's, you know, how can he be a real poet and live here? Mm. Anyway, it was my landlady when I told her about this. I got an invitation. Hillary told her father about this guy, young guy she'd met, who was writing songs or something like that, and Baxter anyway said, oh, I'll bring him around, introduce me to him. So a long shot of it was I did go around to meet her parents, and well, things kind of evolved from there. Mm. In a way.
And, you know, he did his letter to Peter Holles, and you responded with Doctor's Rock.
No, I don't think Doctor's Rock came into it. What's the connection do you draw from that?
As a response.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, that was at his the unveiling.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
I'm with you now. Yeah.
Sorry.
I can't even remember the title now. Four Notes on Jim Baxter, 1 year gone. That's right. It was just a weak attempt. I had, you know, us poets carry notebooks around, you know. Yeah. So when I went up there, that'd be 73 to the unveiling, a year after Baxter's death and Tangi up there, I actually stopped at Jerusalem for a few months on that occasion, and I wrote a bit of stuff in a notebook, and sometime later I pulled some of it out, and that was a little piece. I did make a reply of sorts many years later in a poem just simply called Hemi, which I won't be reading because it's got naughty words in it, but which he invented, or he didn't invent, which he used himself quite liberally.
So. Well, we squeeze another poem in now. I'll do a shout-out to our sponsor, which is apt in this case.
You do.
Step through the door of the University Bookshop into a real bookshop, Dunedin's haven for lovers of the written word. We have a huge, eclectic and diverse selection of books and a feast of quirky gifts. Discover the University Bookshop online or come in and see our friendly, knowledgeable team at 378 Great King Street or phone 477 6976. University Bookshop, Dunedin's finest bookshop, open 7 days.
And thank you to University Bookshop for sponsoring the show. And of course, Peter, you did work at the University Bookshop at one time. So.
Yeah, I did. I did. Quite a few people were sort of part-timers helping out at the UBS. And I scored a job as a cleaner. I must have been in that position for maybe a couple of years. Once a week I'd go in there. And I wrote a poem about it, so I'll read it.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
And that'll explain. It's called Thoughts of Jack Kerouac and Other Things. I worked nights at the university bookshop, junior, intermediate, headman, honorary caretaker, master cleaner. I work in every conceivable position, from toilets, foreign language, to herbal cookery, sometimes singing, "Oh, what a beautiful evening," and sometimes not. Mostly I just race like Neil Cassidy, with an overstuffed vacuum cleaner snarling on my tail, cornering fast on one sneaker past Superwoman and gassing like a madman up the biography one-way section, chewing gum, cigarette butts, paper clips and brains dissolving before my foaming fury. Zap, out the back, empty a tin, grab a bucket, one mop, one broom, flashback past law, modern psychological medicine, heavy granite, colour-filled graffito, art, six-cornered pamphlets, miles of wrapping paper, and up the stairs to the staff room for a coffee break at 8. 10 minutes only. Into the toilet, scrub, shine, wipe on hands and knees, sometimes thinking the closest I come to God and other things, and sometimes not. Mostly, I just thank the Lord for the detention centre experience many rocky youthful years back, and get the hell out of there down the stairs, four at a time, jump over a hot pan paperback, switch off the lights, 5 second silence by the NZ poetry section, scratch my backside, straighten the doormat, lock up, slam the outside door tight, run to the pub, 9 p.m, sweat, feel proud, get half drunk, crawl home, sit down, try to write a love poem to the girl who works in the bookshop office, her typewriter and hairpin, her mystery yogurt containers, her tiny foot scuffed secrets and solitary cheer.
Thank you. Did you ever write that love poem to that lady?
Sorry?
Did you ever write that love poem to that lady?
Well, this was it.
In the
This was it. Yeah, it surprisingly didn't take, well, perhaps it's not so surprisingly, it didn't take me very long to write. I remember walking around later with a pen and paper and wrote down the different sections, you know, Superwoman, biography, yeah. Section law, psychological, graffito art, pamphlets and things like that. And not to leave out New Zealand poetry section, which in those days was very small, but nevertheless prominent enough among all the other stuff. And the poem didn't take too long to write. In fact, in this case, that last stanza, crawl home, write, try to write a love poem to a girl who works in the bookshop office, and it's got an ellipse, three dots after office. I didn't know what was to come afterwards, but I had it already constructed in my head. It was going to be a four-line stanza poem.
Yeah.
So I needed the ending, the typewriter in heaven. So, you know, I had to wait for that a little bit, not very long, probably only the next day.
Bill Dean describes your work in Freeway as central to development of New Zealand literature. How do you feel about such a statement about your work in Freeway?
Well, it was very, perhaps, I was going to say very kind of him to say that, but he probably had been spending too much time in the cook. But, I bow to him, you know, his superior knowledge in these things. You see, I don't have any sense of what's good and what isn't. Yes. And it either moves me or it doesn't, to be honest. And I personally like stuff that's a bit rough around the edges.
Okay.
I was just going to say, I don't know what he saw in me, but he saw something, and anyway.
Do you think New Zealand literature is in a good shape today?
Oh, again, I'm not sure if I'm the sort of person to... I'd probably say yes. There seems to be more people writing today, young people, and publishing.
Yeah.
There's lots of competitions, there's lots going on, there's lots of readings. And
because in the 60s and 70s you were described as the young New Zealand poets. Are you reading any or aware of any of the young poets now?
Was I?
Are you reading any of young New Zealand poets now?
Do I read any? Yes, I keep up with... Well, I read Landfall and... And because I know various people in the publishing world, I tend to sort of pick up stuff like chapbooks and, you know, little privately published things, stuff that's online occasionally. I'm not a heavy online user. I do, you know, I've got one of those smartphones, so I do sort of check in. But it's getting difficult to get published in spite of what I've just said. Well, perhaps the difficulty is the cost.
Yeah.
And because there's so many more people clamouring for the money, I suppose. But cost of printing is very high.
Yeah.
And,
Do you think Dunedin getting its city of literature status is a help or a support for that? Sort of?
Well, I don't know how in practical, you know, how it will in a serve Dunedin in a practical way. I'm not that. It seems to be over on another paddock over the fence. It's not something that. I was hoping you wouldn't ask me about that because I don't know. I can't. I don't know what it means, to be honest. I mean, I think obviously Dunedin has been literary, you know, wherever
that's true,
the Scots and English went in the world, you know, they took their literature with them. And so I don't see any change myself. Okay. You know, Robbie Burns is still in the Octagon and... you know, Charles Brash is still the founder of Landfall and so on, Baxter Liberty,
Evans. And talking about Dunedin itself, you've said that you tend to write more in Dunedin than anywhere else. Do you think there's a particular reason for that? Does Dunedin inspire you more than other places? Or is it just, you know, an environmental thing, that's where you were and that's where you wrote?
No, it did become very special. I left Auckland under a cloud in the mid-60s, and I was one of these kids that felt that I was a bit of a reject, a bit hopeless, you know, that I wouldn't achieve, you know, one of those, as anything much. So... So I felt like I was kicked out of Auckland. My parents thought it was a good idea that I leave the city and try my hand somewhere else. So that's why I came to Dunedin, really. But so I was always, when I went north, I would wind up in trouble again. And, have to clear off and... Dunedin, I'm stumbling a bit here, might have to cut this area. But the thing, the long and short of it is that Dunedin embraced me, or I felt embraced by Dunedin. It didn't reject me. I felt accepted here. And I like the physical side of it, you know, the old buildings and...
Okay.
University and it has a beauty that, and I'm just comparing it with Auckland as Auckland was in the 60s. So it was it just suited me. I don't know why. I liked the winters. I liked a bit of snow. I liked the frost and a much easier city to live in, to get by in, you know. So I would go up north, have a whole bunch of experiences, get myself into a bit of trouble, and then I'd come back to Dunedin and write about it. It was like that for a while.
We've got time for one, to squeeze one more short poem in. Are you okay to read Like a Dream? Do you mind? It's one of my personal favourites.
Oh, okay. Like a Dream. You come round while I'm in the middle of a panic attack. I try to explain what's happening, but it just comes out a muddle. We drink coffee. People with panic disorder shouldn't drink coffee. We talk about the usual things. Are you doing any painting? Am I still writing? But never the words that matter. But when you go, they come, like lumps of thick air surrounded by mist, like a dream you're having while you're still awake, looking at a wall through 6 inches of glass, expecting everything to move at once while you're not actually looking at anything.
Thank you, Peter. It's very well rented, and I sprung that on you in the last minute. And thank you for coming in.
Please, thank you.
That's the end of the show. Thank you to my guest, Peter Owles.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.